Hello, I'm Audrey Brown. Today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about the dangers posed by weapons of war that can and do operate without direct human intervention.
Mankind has evolved laws and norms with respect to warfare, against which accountability may be determined, but with autonomous weapons system, which does not really need any meaningful human control, can destroy whole societies.
It's been of particular concern for West African leaders meeting in Sierra Leone recently. We'll be hearing how the remains of thousands of enslaved Africans on St. Helena connects the remote Atlantic island with the rest of the world. And why is the Nigerian artist Sloan using racist depictions of black people in his art?
I needed it to get them ticking. That's the most spoken about artwork since last year. I'm seeing people having proper dialogues. People are reading through and they're educating themselves on what these racist caricatures are. We're making a mockery of black people's pain. That's the last thing I want to do.
It's Monday, the 22nd of April. First, we go to Sierra Leone. African leaders met in Freetown recently to discuss the dangers posed by autonomous weapons. These are weapons that are deployed remotely without anybody's fingerprints on the gun, as it were, because they are programmed to find and eliminate targets via algorithms. The conference, under the leadership of ECOWAS and the Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio, took a deep look into the use of these weapon systems, focusing particularly on production, distribution, and regulation or permission to use them. What's more, the conference considered the moral and ethical dangers these weapons throw up. West African leaders are particularly concerned about how these weapons can proliferate in a region where they are already being used. Sierra Leone's permanent representative to the United Nations is Lansana Berry, a well-known author of articles and books on the rebel war in his native Sierra Leone. So he knows quite a bit about proliferation and what it can do to fuel and prolong wars. We began our conversation with an explanation of what autonomous weapons are and why their use should be regulated.
They are really emergent military technologies that are very lethal and that they do not need meaningful human involvement to target and to eliminate targets. And that's a real concern. People say, some of the experts say, it is a third great revolution in warfare. The first one was the invention of the gunpowder. As you know, the Chinese invented gunpowder, but never weaponized it. And it was weaponized by the Europeans, and that led to massive large wars and conquest and colonization. And that's a concern here.
You're saying that the concern here is that it will lead to mass killings. There are other machines and weapons that do that right now. Why is this a specific concern?
What it does is that there is a lack of real accountability. I mean, targets are selected by sensors, by algorithm, and not really human beings. You know, over the centuries, mankind has evolved laws and norms and ethical standards with respect to warfare, against which accountability may be determined. But with this kind of thing, autonomous weapons system, which does not really need any meaningful human control, somebody is sitting out there and these algorithms are there. They are fed into sensors and then they pick up targets based upon profiles. It could be racial profiles. It could be gender profiles. And can target people and eliminate them and destroy whole societies. And that's where we are leading. And it's been currently used in the Sahel, for example, in Libya and other places.
So it distances an actual human being involved in doing the killing. It just feeds in information. And as you say, whatever the information is, then the machine goes off and does it. So who's developing these systems? And are there safeguards in place right now as they're being used?
None. It's been developed quite globally. The major military powers around the world are developing it. So in the United States, Russia, most of the major countries with real military technology have been, and they have been used, and used very effectively and devastatingly in many instances. They are currently being used, for example, in the Middle East. They have been used in the Sahel. They have been used in Europe, the Ukraine war. And this is the kind of thing that is very menacing, especially to us in vulnerable secret societies that we don't manufacture these weapons, but it could fall into the wrong hands. Even non-state actors like terrorists can have access to it because it's actually quite cheap. Some of them rudimentary, some, well, you can say rudimentary in Western military sense, but really quite, that would be sophisticated in our own region. And for them to fall into the hands of terrorists or the non-state actors, criminal networks, this will be hugely destabilizing to our region. And we've seen this kind of lack of control leading to a prolonging civil war in Sierra Leone, for example, which is why our government, the government of His Excellency President Julius Maada Bio, is a champion with respect to developing norms around the use of these kinds of weapons.
What norms are currently in place to control these weapons?
Currently, there are absolutely no norm governing the use of these weapons. And there have been discussions for over 10 to 12 years in the CCW Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons in Geneva and elsewhere to try and reach an agreement on some kind of way forward to develop a framework, some kind of legally binding instrument. But these are all these conversations have stalled because there are major, major interests preventing them going forward. Powerful governments, powerful private interests, the military industrial complex. So they don't want this conversation to go forward, which is why many of us from small countries have decided to take this fall to our countries and our regions, regional areas like ECOWAS, and they've done it in Latin America. It's been done in the Caribbean. Philippines held a larger conference as well, bringing together regional governments to take a decision and put pressure on everyone. The UN Secretary General has made it a policy brief years ago, asking for a legally binding document to govern the use of this weapon.
What would be the guiding principles of a legally binding document? What do we need to have in there, given that these weapons seem to be a fait accompli?
The draft has not been done yet, and the devil will be in the detail once we get to the drafting stage. But it will be determination of accountability and also about the movement of these, the sale, the movement, replication of these weapons. There will have to be a framework, guidelines around the sale of them, the manufacture of them, and traceability. I mean, there has to be a system in place to trace their use and hold countries responsible. And once countries sign up to it, proliferation may be checked. Since the atomic bomb, the nuclear bomb was invented, and the convention, the framework was worked out, international atomic agency, several treaties, that really has prevented the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Has it really? Has it really prevented the proliferation? There are countries that still have nuclear weapons. Some countries are prevented from having them. But also the proliferation of small arms, for instance, in your region particularly, doesn't stop arms from proliferating and from people using those arms to kill other people, whether it's state actors or non-state actors. It seems like we do not have the handle as human beings on weapons at all, and we just create more and more dangerous weapons. And now we're even removing ourselves from the killing as a species, you know, and killing other people. It seems to me that we're moving towards creating more efficient killing machines rather than stopping killing machines and killers from developing.
On one level, I think you're absolutely right. But what a framework, a legally binding document, will do is to determine accountability. I mean, look at, for example, biological weapons. So many countries have those weapons, but their use is actually very rare. In large part because there's a revulsion against it. There's a biological weapons convention, and you know, countries draw red lines based upon that convention.
That wasn't the case in Syria, though. I mean, when they used chemical weapons there were red lines, and those red lines were ignored, and the destruction of human beings on that basis wasn't followed up.
Yes, but you know the outrage that provoked. That outrage, I'm sure, prevented the promiscuous use both in Syria and elsewhere. Without that kind of framework, a lot of people, because these weapons are actually quite cheap to produce. So no, the instrument is extremely important, because then you can use that as a yardstick to measure accountability and to put pressure. I mean, these are legal as well as ethical and moral rules. There will be rogue actors, but this will be fairly limited.
How can you stop it from getting into the area and falling into the wrong hands?
That's a very difficult question. How do we ensure it by trying to enforce whatever legally binding framework is worked out. As ECOWAS, we do have a strong record of arms control. ECOWAS' small arms convention that we have has been quite effective in controlling the movement of small arms. And we have small arms commissions in almost every ECOWAS country. Weapons and guns, for example, are marked. Now, the danger with autonomous weapon system is that non-state actors can actually have access to them, terrorists and other insurgents and criminal networks. That will be difficult to control, of course, but then the more likely it won't be produced here. It will be produced elsewhere. That is where the pressure will be mounted, those areas of production, not to sell them, not to transfer them to these places which do not produce them and which are vulnerable societies, which is why those countries will have to be part of the framework, will have to be part of the legally binding instrument, which is why there is currently resistance to it, because once they are part of it, it becomes part of the global order.
So tell us, what are the key conclusions that the conference that you've just been attending have come to?
Well, the key conclusion is that ECOWAS makes a commitment to act in a coordinated way for a legally binding instrument to support the Secretary General, UN Secretary General's call for a legally binding instrument governing the production, the circulation of autonomous weapon systems. That's the main one, that we will act as one voice to push this agenda to the United Nations. And the report of the conference will be sent to the UN. And similar conferences may be held in other parts of West Africa. ECOWAS has taken the lead as the first regional conference on autonomous weapons in Africa.
Were there other countries outside of Africa as a region present there? Anybody from the United States? Anybody from Canada? From the UK?
I didn't see, but certainly Russia sent three representatives, including the ambassador in Guinea, who covers Sierra Leone. There were lots of other folks who came in there. I haven't seen the list of attendees, but people certainly came at the opening, and there was a lot of interest in the outcome document. The European Union called to find out what it is when it was still under negotiations. We have not released it. So many countries are very interested. People travel from all over Asia, some from parts of Europe, Latin America, the Caribbean, to come and attend it. Argentina, we had delegates from all those places who came around in Freetown to be part of this conference. So no, there is a growing interest in making sure that this legally binding instrument is finally realized. And that's what the communique called for. And it's called for certain regulations to be in place because they are easily replicable. And that's really one frightening aspect of these weapons.
In the interest of our listeners understanding clearly what the dangers are, could you just spell them out for us succinctly?
These weapons are easily available currently, and they are available to almost everyone. Currently, the concentration is in those powerful countries. As I said, they've been transferred to parts of Africa. And somebody, a small group of people, will be sitting out there and target folks miles and miles away. And here's one huge major danger. And this actually was brought forward by one of the contributors yesterday. Now, one of the deterrents for major countries to go to war, to invade others, is the fear of casualties. Their troops will get killed, their militaries will get decimated, they'll take casualties, tens of thousands of them. I mean, the United States doesn't want to go to war in certain instances for the simple fear that they will incur casualties and the home front will not be happy. The same thing in Europe and other countries. But with the development of autonomous weapons, the fear of casualty is completely eliminated. So you have now incentive to go to warfare by very major countries because they know that they'll kill others who might not have the technology to hit back. And their soldiers will not be in harm's way. Their own citizens will not be in harm's way. That is a very, very major fear.
And do these systems, can they kill large numbers of people as well at the same time?
Yes. Potentially, they can kill large numbers of people. They can destroy even cities as they are developing now. The growth of these weapons is so fast. The potency has been increasing almost on a daily basis to the point that some of them can target whole areas and completely eliminate those areas, incurring hundreds of thousands of casualties. So it's not the minor menace, it's a very major menace. As I say, it is a third great revolution in warfare. Gunpowder, then it came to nuclear weapons, and now these autonomous weapon system is really menacing, it is very dangerous, and it is potentially something that will cause massive havoc. It is already causing massive havoc in parts of the world. Part of the reason why we champion this as a country in Sierra Leone, this conversation started in Geneva with our mission, but the president was very enthusiastic about it and decided, well, no, Sierra Leone should host conference, this kind of regional conference. In large part because of our own history, as you know, we were emerged from a terrible civil war. And part of the reasons why that war was failed was because of the lack of control over the movement of small arms. And then that caused a lot of havoc to us. Some of those who were traitors of the war were foreigners who were never held to account. So we are very concerned about prevention and accountability, and we are concerned about, as a small country, we are concerned about a multilateral approach to issues, because on our own, we are not powerful enough to be able to defend ourselves completely from powerful forces. So we strongly, strongly attach to multilateral actions like this one.
It's a better note for us to end on. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Sierra Leone's permanent representative to the United Nations, Lansana Berry. Next, let's go to St. Helena. It's one of those places you may have heard of, but you might not know exactly where it is. You might know that the 19th century General Napoleon Bonaparte was exiled there after being defeated by the British in the Battle of Waterloo. What is less known about this Atlantic Ocean island is that it played a part in the slave trade. It is around 1,900 kilometers away from mainland Africa, and until the early 2000s was only accessible by a six-day-long ship ride from its nearest neighbors, Angola, South Africa, and Namibia. Then the British government, which governs the territory, decided to build an airport, and when the work started, it made the news headlines.
In 2011, the British government announced the construction of an airport on St. Helena. It's going to change the islanders' way of life forever.
The new airport became fully operational in 2017, connecting the islanders, or saints as they like to be called, to the rest of the world. Now, anyone can reach the island in just 6 hours by air. But in the years before the airport construction began, archaeologists carrying out a feasibility study at the site came upon grave sites.
325 bodies were exhumed by archaeological excavation, and they were placed in boxes and kept in storage for later being reburied. In 2012, that's when I came to the island as a part of the construction team, and we would commence with the works. And then throughout the course of the construction of the airport, we encountered more human remains, which we would then collect, put in more boxes, and put into storage with the rest of those that were archaeologically excavated.
That's Anina Fanil, who was part of the advance team in 2012. When she found out about the 325 bodies being exhumed and that the remains of as many as 10,000 former African slaves, including children, could still be in those graves, she began advocating for a full investigation and for a fitting memorialization to honor all those who lay there. Anina, now back in her home country, Namibia, after 12 years on the island, takes up the story.
So yes, as part of the airport construction project, we had to come face to face with this traumatic history of the transatlantic slave trade, where up to 27,000 formerly enslaved Africans were brought to the island of St. Helena and quarantined in Rupert's Valley. A third of them didn't make it out of the island. 17,000 were shipped on, but 10,000 were buried on the island, and that's what we encountered.
Which parts of the world did they come from?
The ships would have been sailing directly out of Angola and on their way to Brazil, and this was during the illegal slave trade era with Portuguese vessels. So the British Navy would intercept these vessels as an act of abolition of slavery and ending this illegal slave trade between 1840 and the 1870s. And then the island of St. Helena was strategically positioned as like a halfway outpost to liberate, as in hyphenated commas, as they were called, liberating these formerly enslaved Africans on the island of St. Helena. Unfortunately, they weren't taken back home to Africa. They were shipped on to the British Caribbean to continue working for the British.
But not enslaved, more indentured, a different form of forced labor, right?
Exactly, indentured labor.
So how come these remains were unearthed, uncovered in the course of the work that you were doing for the airport? Were they deliberately uncovered for reburial, or were they discovered by accident? What happened?
It's really a combination of both. Prior to the airport construction works commencing in 2008, they did an archaeological excavation, which would make sure that any construction work on that site in Rupert's Valley would not disturb any of the graves. But within the first 8 months of being there, we came across remains because the boundaries of this burial ground were not exactly known.
So did you find the outer limits of the burial site, and were you able to protect those sites then while the construction was going on? Or did construction stop and plans change?
Unfortunately, plans did not change. There would have been minor pauses between any of these findings just to mitigate and protect as much as we could what we thought were the limits, or the, you know, expanded limits of our initial assumption of where the burial grounds lay. But the only way to really find out exactly what the perimeters are of that site is to do proper investigations with the intention of protecting the site primarily. When we were working on the airport project, the objective was to build the airport site. And unfortunately, these disturbances kept occurring. And hopefully now that will change.
Why do you think things will change now?
Well, now we're involving the ancestral communities, the direct descendants. So some of the liberated Africans, in hyphenated commas, they stayed on St. Helena, approximately 500 of them, and became part of what we know as the St. Helena population today. But the rest of them were shipped onto the British Caribbean. And then also we know that the ancestral communities deriving from the Congo Kingdom, so Congo with a K, due to extensive DNA research that was done on the human remains to find out exactly their origins. Now we can incorporate these discussions and these conversations with the descendants globally in order to find out what is the right thing to do, which will include the rites and rituals that are associated with reburial ceremonies, correct memorialization by reinterpreting the narrative that previously took a colonial lens, and incorporating the true authorities of these remains.
So just to clarify, the airport construction went ahead, and as they went, whatever bones they found were dug up and boxed and stored for future memorialization, or is the process of memorialization and honorable reburial actually going to happen or happening?
So in 2022, the 325 that were archaeologically excavated, as well as the additional remains that were found during construction, were reburied by the St. Helena community and the St. Helena government. So 2 years later now, they're starting to talk about memorialization and interpretation of the history. Additionally, with the work that I'm doing, is making sure that the African diaspora and descendants globally and the African continent, the ancestral kingdoms and queendoms, are allowed to participate in that discussion and that conversation that involves their traumatic history too. So that is still to be done. However, the reburial ceremony has taken place and took place nearly 2 years ago now.
How connected are the people or the saints? How connected do they feel to the remains and to the history that is attached to it?
When I first started working on the project, it was as disconnected as I was from my own African heritage and my own African memory and connection to the transatlantic slave trade. And that's part of the reason why I made an effort to reconnect the descendant community on St. Helena and the wider community to this incredible site and this uncomfortable history And it's growing, it's changing, it's taking time. Naturally, it will take time because there are so many barriers that exist against having comfortable conversations about such an uncomfortable topic. And there are so many systems in play that don't facilitate conversations being had and actually encourages silence when it comes to healing and dealing with a traumatic past. So the saints, as they're called, are still in the process of uncovering exactly what that history means to them.
Now, the people that were in authority at the time of the period of enslavement, the British, the Portuguese, etc., how involved are they in this?
Yeah, it's hard to say. The involvement has been resistance, if anything. The conversation just is not being had. On the other side, we have the Dutch who are actually actively having the conversation, and they've entered into a formal apology to their territories, the Dutch Caribbean, and the effects and the impacts that slavery has had on those descendant communities. So globally, it is a conversation that's difficult to be had, but we see sides and European nations that are engaging in the discussion and the conversation, and then we see those that are still in a stage of denial. But also, you have to have people of African descent around the table when decisions are being made about African heritage. That's one of the first steps that needs to be taken.
You went there in a completely different capacity. You end up in a completely different role with a completely different sense of purpose. Why is this so important to you? What changed you about it?
You know, when I went to St. Helena, I was completely lacking in identity. And I was okay with it until I encountered the site that held so much identity and was rich and boasting with the beautiful heritage of the African continent. You know, yes, it's tied to a traumatic past, but the loving way and some of these bodies were laid to rest by the people closest to them. And you can see that through the archaeology. And it reconnected me to a part that I wasn't aware of. And that is absolutely precious to me. And it's hard to let go of that.
Anina Faniel, now back in Namibia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Our next story continues the discussion about slave histories and how far into the future they can reach. As we know, history can be sweet, but it can also be bitter, very bitter. And when it's bitter, how does one tell it without unearthing generations of pain and anguish? Is that even possible? These are the questions that arise from the works of a young Nigerian artist known as Sloan. He recently sold a painting for almost three times more than its estimated value at the UK's biggest auction house, Sotheby's. A worthy cause for celebration, some would say. Not exactly. He has since faced huge backlash online for depicting black people in something called blackface, a style and practice rooted in slavery and the dehumanization of black people. My colleague Nyasha Michelle spent some time with the artist at his studio here in London. So tell me about the uproar regarding the painting.
So the uproar with this painting was because of, firstly, how it looks like. You've got three black men who have got this very dark black skin, and then their lips are very big, kind of like clowns and painted red. So to our listeners, if they visualize it, they would think, hey, that kind of sounds like blackface. And essentially, that's what people felt that it looked like. And then the second thing was Nigerians in particular were very, very offended because of the name. It's called Three Yoruba Brothers. So if you have a picture that looks like blackface and you're also calling it a name of a tribe on the continent, it was very offensive to a lot of people.
And they also have Nigerian names, right?
They have Nigerian names. Mm. They do have Nigerian names.
Yoruba names, yes, specifically.
Exactly. And blackface, founded in racism, degradation of black people, dehumanization of black people. So there was a lot of uproar about it because they essentially felt like he was making a caricature of black people, Nigerian people, and slavery and all the pain that they experienced during that time.
Let's talk about the history of blackface and minstrels, because this is what he's basing his practice on. This is what these kinds of paintings evoke.
Minstrel performances is actually quite disturbing when it comes to the history of it. It started before the American Civil War in the 1800s when white performers put on black makeup. And they also wore disheveled clothing, which imitated and mimicked enslaved Africans on southern plantations. These performances characterized black people as lazy, ignorant, superstitious, hypersexual threats to white women and even thieves. So in short, it really was a way of dehumanizing black people and portraying them as subhuman. And it's very important as well to know that these minstrel performances were mainly done for the entertainment of white audiences. It wasn't until very, very recently, 1960s, 1950s, that it was not necessarily outlawed, but it was seen as, okay, no, this is not right for us to be doing.
I can't imagine that he didn't know what he was doing.
Oh, he did. He knew exactly what he was doing. There was a lot of uproar online, and we asked him what he felt about that. Is it something that he did on purpose? And essentially, he was saying, yes, it was to provoke emotion.
I needed it to get them ticking. That's the most spoken about artwork since last year. I'm seeing people having proper dialogues. People are reading through and they're educating themselves on what these racist caricatures are. There's a lot of Disney films and cartoons that you grew up watching that it was just perfectly normal to have that in there. So by the time I knew what it was, I was just like, wow, this is insane that people just have that in their face. I'm not making a mockery of black people's pain. That's the last thing I'd want to do. It's not a mockery. Don't focus on the art. The art is just a vehicle, bro. I have a cafe in East London, right? We have an art club there. Loads of kids, black kids, Nigerian kids, Jamaican kids, coming to the art club. Are you going to put the money in my pocket to buy the materials for them to get canvases and stuff to paint? I ask any of them, yo, everyone donate so that we can have constant materials. They won't do it.
Someone asked you who your target audience is.
And you said racist.
And in another post, you said, I'm making an app where white people can pay to call me N-word anonymously. So satire. Why would you do that?
Wow. Oh, my God. Satire exists. Why would I make an app for white people to degrade me so that I can make money? Why would my target audience be racist? They don't like black people. Let me tell you something here. You see all these artworks I make here. White people are too scared. They could never approach me to buy work like that.
So it wasn't a white person who bought it? Because someone asked you who bought it and you said a white person.
The person was Nigerian. The whole point is that the things I say are so outrageous that they can't be true, but people take them as true.
So you're just saying this to evoke a reaction, these things, even if they're rooted in very painful history.
There's a lot of things that are rooted in painful history of black people. People still paint them. People still make videos of them.
Right. So that's Sloan. His intention clearly is to satirize and to provoke. And I'm just wondering how responsive or how aware are African audiences of that?
Based on the response that his painting had online, African audiences are very aware of blackface and the offense it causes and the pain in not just African Americans, but black people of different backgrounds. Over here in the UK, there actually were minstrel performances. When you look at the comments online, there were a lot of people who were offended, who really felt that it didn't just attack African Americans, it attacked all black people.
Right. So by the sounds of it, he faced huge backlash and response. What did he say about that? And what did he say about how it affected his family?
So there was a lot of backlash that he experienced, and that visibly did impact him. And one of the reasons is because he also has a very interesting background and experience he had when he was in Nigeria, based on his color and just based on some of the things that he's suffered. So this is what he had to say when we put that to him.
I was way, way darker than I am now when I was in Nigeria. So you grew up being like, hey, blackie. I grew up getting all these stupid insults from both Nigerians and Americans. Bro, I had really, really bad ADHD. I had, even now I'm like shaking, sitting down. Not shaking, but I'm twitching. Like, I have to move. I had bigger issues to deal with. I grew up in a upsy-downsy house where sometimes things are okay, then things are really bad. I had way bigger issues, bro. And it's just like a boy like me, I had big dreams and they seemed really far away for me. So I took things into my own hands. I've seen people do it before. Cause mayhem of controversy, then take from it, then build. I want to build something that stays forever and ever, even if you have to hate me now for it.
It seems to me that he's quite thoughtful as an artist,
mm-hmm.
and that he is campaigning in a way about what art can do and what art should do. But you met him. Did you feel that it was a publicity stunt that's gone too far? Or is this a genuine attempt on his part to move perceptions and to make people discuss things at a deeper level, as he says he wants to do?
By Sloan standards, it worked. People were talking about it.
They were very angry.
Emotions were evoked, and he was happy with that. He did not mind being the villain. But by the public standard, based on a lot of the comments that were coming out on social media and the blog, I don't really think for them it worked, because you can carry out a message, you can send a message, you can communicate a message without necessarily having to pick on old wounds. And that's what a lot of the people online, African people and African-American people who were commenting, kind of, that's the sentiment that they gave.
Do you think it'll do him damage? You know, have you seen any of his other works? Are they in the similar vein or are they completely different?
When it comes to the key identity of how his paintings kind of look like, there is a uniformity there. So you have the big lips and... for some of them, you do have the dark skin. So that is something that he does all the time.
It's his trademark.
It's his trademark. So what he was saying was he has a lot of people online trolling him. And so if they're going to troll him, he's going to troll them back. So as an artist who wants you to be talking about him, he's going to ride that wave until some of you realize, okay, you know what? This offense is not worth it because this person is actually making fun of us. But is that too far? Because it is a genuine experience, terrible experiences that generations of Black people went through.
And still do.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, in American colleges and so on, there are often dolls or effigies being hanged by their necks in Absolutely. The way people did during the era when that used to happen to Black people. So it's a way of intimidating and, and terrifying Black people now.
And in some terrible instances, you've actually had... during Halloween, because Halloween is such a popular holiday in America, you've had a lot of famous people and a lot of college students wear blackface.
Well, famously, the Prime Minister of Canada in his student days did the same, and he apologized for it. So clearly the ramifications of this will go on and on and on. It seems to me like Sloan is particularly guilty of expecting social media to understand nuance and irony and sarcasm. Big mistake.
Yeah, some people online are taking it literally.
I was talking there to Nyasha Michelle, my colleague, who went to talk to Sloan and took a look at his work. Focus on Africa was put together by Nyasha Michelle, Victor Silver and Patricia Whitehorn. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of operations. Our technical producer, Johnny Hall, made sure we got on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.